Hey everybody, I'm Ken. I'm an alcoholic. Nice to be here with you tonight. As Sam said, my home group is the Into Action group in Richmond, Virginia, and a couple of guys nice enough to drive up with me tonight. I appreciate that, and I want to thank Sam for inviting me up to speak tonight. And my sobriety date is June 20th, 2006, and I'm glad to be here tonight. I tell you, there's nowhere, truly nowhere I'd rather be, and that's just an amazing statement to me to even be able to stand here and honestly say that. But when I first came into AA in 2002, I fought this thing tooth and nail. I tell you, I didn't particularly want to be here. I wasn't quite sure you guys had a solution. I could see folks weren't drinking, and they looked kind of happy, but, you know, I'm a slow learner. I don't pick up on this stuff too fast. What I saw was a bunch of people sitting there who just didn't have driver's license, car insurance, lost their wives, had health problems, DUIs, and I didn't have any of that stuff. And they were sitting there going, and if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, I was thinking, man, what are they talking about? But, you know, thank God. I don't know how the thing ended up clicking for me, but I'm convinced if it hadn't, I would not be standing here or anywhere else tonight. I mean, I'm fully convinced we have a fatal progressive disease, that the drinking doesn't get us the thinking will. Because yesterday I got up, I didn't have any work to do, which isn't good. I sell real estate. I ought to be working on Saturday morning, you know. I'm doing the laundry, taking out the trash, getting some dishes done instead, and I'm starting to resent my family right away. Because half of them are still asleep. The ones up trying to help are not doing it right. In fact, I started looking back on what they've done the rest of the week while I was in AA and working and whatnot, and it occurs to me they're doing some other stuff wrong. And I'm thinking maybe I need to drop a few F-bombs around here and straighten this thing out, you know. But I didn't have to do it, you know. I don't have to harm my family like that anymore. Well, it doesn't mean I'll ever do it. I'm not perfect at this thing, but by and large, I don't have to do that stuff anymore, and I've got a way of living here that enables me, hopefully, to not to get in that bad shape to begin with, and if I do, to do a step 10 on it and catch it and get back on track. And, yeah, I tell you, like I said, when I came into AA and they said they had a fatal disease, I couldn't believe that either. Didn't particularly want what they have and knew I didn't have what they had, you know, if they had a fatal disease. Because, see, I could jump on my bicycle, ride from Richmond to Williamsburg and back and not think twice about it. And I'd driven drunk my whole life, and I'd always been able to keep it pretty close between the middle line and the ditch, right? And I figured that was the only thing that could really do me in as far as alcoholism would be to wreck the car or something like that. But haven't been in it a few years, and look around, I see people die from this thing just all the time, you know. I was reading a paper one day and just flipping through, getting ready to go to work, and I see a picture of a girl I've known for 17 years, and she did all of my mortgage banking, or 80-90% of it, in real estate for, I don't know, last 12 or 14 years. And I look at this thing and I go, Jackie must have won an award. Here's her picture in the paper, you know. And I said, my gosh, she's in the obituaries. And I called the office. I asked a couple of people what happened, you know. Nobody knew. I went to the funeral, and at the end of it, kind of an odd thing for a funeral, but I guess a lot of people were wondering what had happened to her. And she had committed suicide, and they read her suicide note. She said, "I'm basically, the gist of the note was this: I'm totally baffled by life. I want to be a good mother. I want to be a good daughter, and I'm unable to do it. I keep getting sucked into drugs and alcohol, and this is the only logical solution I can see to the thing. And I believed, without a shadow of a doubt, my thinking, my alcoholism would take me right down that same route if I didn't stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would be right there, you know. I don't have any question about it. I've had this thing come on me in sobriety, you know. And that's the only reason I'm here today. I can drive in the mountains and see some pretty scenery pretty much any time I want to, you know. I didn't come up here to see the scenery tonight. I came up here because I was asked to do something in AA, and I'm convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt, if I don't stay active doing this stuff and trying to help people, I'm going to I'm going to end up where Jackie did, you know. And, on and on it goes. We had another guy in my home group. We went over to Retreat Hospital in downtown Richmond a few months ago, and basically we went in this guy's room. He's in hospice, you know, congestive heart failure. He's just done to death by alcoholism, and just unrecognizable from what he was just a few months earlier. But here he is, another alcoholic who didn't believe this thing was fatal, sitting here dying from alcoholism, and today's dead, you know. And, I didn't know what alcoholism was. I think I've been in the sights of this thing from the day I was born. I know I was born into a family, a whole family, the drinkers and non-drinkers alike in it, terribly affected by the disease of alcoholism. My mom was a raging alcoholic, and it's just a strange way to grow up, you know. When I look back at my childhood, I think all in all it was pretty good. We were out in the country. We worked hard. We were taught a tremendous work ethic. We were taught good morals. They took us to church every Sunday. All these things, you know. And then had three brothers, and we'd play basketball and go fishing and hunting in the fall, and I look back on it, it looked like a pretty decent childhood, and man, I wish my kids could get a dose of it, you know. I'm like, man, that was good stuff. But I always knew something was wrong in that household, and the thing that was kind of doing us all in was alcoholism. And, we weren't all drinking. Dad was a social drinker, but he's always trying to make the family look normal. He's always baffled about what has happened to the woman he married, you know, who's now so caught up in this disease that I believe Mom truly loves us, you know. I believe she always did. I think this disease of alcoholism kept her from being able to effectively love her. When I love people, I do things for them, you know. I do loving things. And then many times when the kids got between Mom and the gin at night after she got home from work, she was unable to do loving things, you know. And so it's kind of crazy, kind of a crazy environment to grow up in. And I don't think it made me alcoholic. I think I had probably a genetic predisposition to become alcoholic that came from her side of the family. When we looked up at the great uncle I'm named after was an alcoholic. Her brother killed himself, committed suicide in his late teens. A couple of other suicides further up the family tree. And family doesn't sit around and talk about it a lot, but you talk to a couple of the old-timers in our family and you see the little hints of alcoholism, and if you start prying a little bit, it's clearly there. And I've got it. I'm different from normal people. I've got this thing called alcoholism. And to me, it's just step one. I am bodily and mentally different from other people. I can't safely drink. And not only that, I can't run my own life. My life is unmanageable by me. It cannot be. I saw what running it for 46 years did. I was a failure in every department, you know. Here I am with three kids, and I'm telling myself the big lie. I said, my drinking is not affecting anybody else. And I looked at my wife, and I said, why is she so ill at ease with this thing? All I would need to do is a little bit of this in the morning, maybe a little bit in the evening and a lot on the weekends, and I'd be okay, you know. And she didn't like it. So, but I couldn't see that I was affecting my wife, that she was having to take on roles in the family that she shouldn't have to take on. I couldn't see that I'm there for the kids, but I'm not really there for the kids, you know. I'm out in the tool shed or doing what I got to do to be okay in life, or down in the basement hiding from them. I'm not the guy up there helping them with homework or pitching baseballs in the backyard or just teaching kids life lessons that they ought to be getting from their parents, you know. And I look back in sobriety and go, my God, thank God I got this thing straightened out. When I did, I think my kids would have been destroyed by this thing, and I don't have any question about it. But anyway, get on through life, and I got that thing you hear every alcoholic talk about. I just felt like other people knew something about life I didn't know. They knew how to fit into it a little better. They were a little more at ease in it. They seemed to get along with each other. And I just couldn't be included for some reason. I'm kind of always on the outside of whoever it was, a group of kids on the bus, a group of kids in the hallway at school or whoever it is. I'm kind of on the outside of it, desperately wanting to be in it and fitting in a little bit here and there, but by and large just feeling totally separated from it. And just a strange feeling. I thought so. I started looking at it. I think I don't know how consciously I'm thinking this stuff, but I started thinking, man, it comes from growing up on a little tobacco farm in the middle of nowhere. You know, other people know things that I don't know. It comes from not having enough stuff. You know, if I get older and get a job, I'm going to get blah blah X Y Z. You know, and life's going to be good. And that's really what I thought. And so anyway, I'm in this crazy alcoholic household, and but we made it look pretty good. I think to the casual observer, we probably looked as about as normal as anybody down there. But anybody that looked very close and peeled the onion back a couple of layers, they would see some weird stuff going on. And so when I was 16, I think this feeling of separation was instantly magnified in my life. I had a tire blow up in my face, and had all these eye surgeries and all this stuff, and had the skin grafted down over my eye for a year, and the kids in high school got quite a kick out of it for some reason. And you know, just intensified that whole separation thing, and I went from being, you know, basically a BC student to a guy that's barely passing anything, and just totally depressed, totally wondering what's wrong with life. And so anyway, it kind of messed up my grades the last couple of years. So I'm getting ready to graduate, and all my friends are going off to wherever, you know, Tech, UVA, James Madison, all these schools. And I don't have the grades to go anywhere. I'm going to the community college, which, and the only thing that bothered me about that was I'm sentenced to 2 more years at home with Mom. And at this point, you know, I started drinking in high school, not much. I was mostly looked at myself as an athlete. I played football, I ran track, I lifted weights to get ready to do those things when I wasn't doing them, and that's the crowd I hung out with. I had a few guys in there I became pretty good friends with, and we'd drink beer every once in a while, and we'd drink and get drunk, you know, and but it wasn't any big deal. Didn't have any real consequences from it, and but anyway, here I am, stuck at home, and in my drinking, when I look back on it, it is slowly starting to pick up as I get into the local community college and all this. But at this point, I still got the ability to knuckle down on stuff, you know. And I'm like, man, I'm not going back home. I'm not going to stay down here on this farm anymore than I have to get whatever credits I got to get out of this school to get out of here. And I make pretty much straight A's, you know, and off I go to Virginia Tech, and I got up there, and things went pretty well. My roommate left a week before school was supposed to start, but that wasn't good. So a guy from, indirectly through some friends, a guy from Arizona moves in with me, and he's going to be an engineer, and I didn't know what I was going to be in. I was just, this is the way I decide things, you know. I don't decide. I just let them happen. The reason I went to Tech was because a brother in front of me went to Tech, and I could get his apartment because he had just graduated. So it made all the sense in the world to me. I didn't, not a guy that sits down and thinks through it. Yeah, I want to be X, Y, Z. This is a school to go to for that, because at the time I could have gotten into a lot of places, you know. But here's an apartment, and off I go. And so I get up there, and things go pretty well. My roommate's in a real program. He's in engineering, and he's got to study a lot, you know. And we're tearing it up the first couple of quarters. We're both making A's and B's, and stayed up there over spring break, and we're doing our laundry. And I go to throw Mike's stuff out of the washer over in the dryer so I can get my stuff started, and hear these rolling papers all over the washing machine. And I was from the country, but I wasn't that far from the country. I knew rolling papers when I saw them. I said, well, we got something in common here, and we start talking about it. And I think that's all two alcoholics have to do is come up with any little excuse to get started, and off we went. Our grades went right in the toilet from there on, you know. So, and I went through that cycle. I'm out partying as much as I can. My grades are going down. I get the letter from the dean, Mr. Thompson, we're going to kick you out if you don't get your grades up next quarter. So I slack off a bit. I don't stop. I think my ability to really totally stop for an extended period of time is starting to vanish along here. But I can get my grades back up, and then it's the same thing. It's like up and down and up and down. And after a few years of it, I finally, I should have gotten out of there in 2 years, but I was up there 3. I liked it so much. And, we'd get up there and host these parties, and I'd start drinking. And to me, it was like lighting a rocket and straddling that thing and riding it for all it was worth. You know, I was just a shy kid, always trying to fit in with people. Yet I started drinking at these keg parties and pouring the hard liquor down and whatnot and whatever drugs were around. And man, I'm just on fire. I'm the life of the party. People are like, yeah, look at Ken. He's breaking this. And I'm out there breaking the trees down in front of the apartment complex, you know. And I'm smashing furniture. And I'm chasing people around with easy chairs. And put people in the shower and stick them outdoors in 0 degrees and turn them into an icicle. It was just a big hooch, you know. And I loved it, man. And the more they talked about me, the more I did it. It kind of became, I got involved in some other, you know, caving and stuff up there like that. And that's who I hung around with, all the cavers. Well, I don't want to denigrate an organization, but they're pretty much drunks, the best I can tell. Most of them were. We weren't drunk underground, but when we came out, the party was on, and until we went back under, the party didn't end, you know. And so that's who I hung out with. I was a heavy drinker among heavy drinkers, you know. And they're out there laughing. There's Kent puking in the parking lot again. There's Kent blah, blah, breaking this and doing that. And so I liked it. The more entertained they were, the more I wanted to do it. But anyway, I managed to eke out of there with my economics degree after 3 years of that stuff. I think a degree in basket weaving would have been more useful. I got to tell you, I got out in the recession of 1983 with my econ degree. And my alcoholic thinking tells me there's an important position in federal government for me. And I need to move up to D.C. and claim it. And after they laughed me out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics and every other department up there, I'm like, I wonder what I should do now. Well, I did the logical thing. I started managing a basement waterproofing company. Made perfect sense to me. They paid money, all right. So anyway, and that went pretty well for a couple of months, and then the flood hit. It rained and snowed for about 3 weeks in a row, you know. I went from getting 6 calls a day and been there in the office to about 306. And I got 6 salesmen, and I'm supposed to be routing them around Maryland and D.C. and Northern Virginia, and I don't know who's going where, and they hate my guts, and I didn't like them that much. And finally, one day, I'd had enough of it. This is how much consideration I had for most people in my life. It occurred to me they hadn't properly trained me for such an emergency, and I shouldn't be put under this much duress at work, and they weren't paying me enough anyway, and I was leaving. And I mean, this is at lunchtime. This isn't, I'm going to give 2 weeks' notice. I'm going to be out of here by 1 o'clock when they get back. So I got in my truck, and I'm boxed in. But I'm a clever alcoholic. I drove across the ditch and got on Route 1 and got out of there, you know. I said, man, that is rough out there in the real world. I think I'll go back to school. So I called Mom up. I said, can you send me some money? I want to go back to school. And I don't know. I guess Mom had enough guilt about all this stuff that had gone on that she, you know, was willing to put me through school again, you know. Some weird thing. I'm not going to teach my kid responsibility and to be self-supporting and all this stuff. We're just going to be in some weird relationship, and I'm going to pay for him to go back. Here he is, an adult, 24 years, whatever I was at that point. So I go back, and I get a finance degree in 1 year, and the heat was on again, you know. I mean, I'm partying, but I'm like, man, that first set of employers I interviewed did not like my grades. I think I'll see if I can come out of here with some decent grades this time. And I did, and one of them was a little sticky, statistics. I could not make a click with that stuff, so I did. Came up with a good alcoholic ploy for that. I moved in with my statistics professor, the head of the department. So that knocked that one out, and I did made some pretty good grades, you know. And so I get out of there, and I go to work for this little company, and it's auditing company. We flew all over the country to these chicken producers, and look, they paid money, I'm telling you. A little bit anyway. Yeah, I could care less. If they count chickens, they count anything they want to, as long as they sent that check every couple of weeks. So we're going around to these companies, and we're getting all these thousands of cost and operating statistics, and it blew my mind, because I'm a bit of a perfectionist, you know, and I was so afraid I was going to put one of these numbers in the wrong place or say the wrong thing to the wrong person at the wrong time or something. I could barely perform in this job, and I thought I was doing great. That's the level of that's the accuracy of my perception. I literally thought I was doing great. So they called me in at the end of the first year, the number two guy in the company, you know. I said, this is going to be good. Old Bill's going to put the promotion on me. He said, Kent, we may have to fire you if you don't get faster at doing these audits. I'm like, my God, is he talking to me? And I'm looking around the room to see who he's talking to, you know. I couldn't believe it. I went out of there in shock, you know. And but here I am again. The heat is on. I'd get out on the road. I'd stay up all night working on these audits. I found some time savers, you know. I quit icing the beer down. I just drink it out of the box and keep the computer there, and I'm clicking away all night. And I come home on Thursday instead of Friday. I save the company a day's travel expenses. I've got my audit done. I'm tearing it up. In fact, I became the fastest guy in the history of that company to get promoted to the senior analyst level, where you go back and present the reports to the management of these companies. And at that point, when they gave me that promotion, suddenly that whole job was so beneath me, you know. Yeah, look at these chicken counters. Now they want me in here, you know. And they wanted to send me on the road, and I'm supposed to go. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't go. I've got another job. And I think I gave them just under 2 weeks' notice, but it wasn't much. They're like, what are we going to do in this upcoming round of management meetings? I said, I could care less. I mean, I didn't say that, but that's what I'm thinking, and that's essentially what I told them, you know. And out the door I go, you know. And went to the next company. No sane person would have taken this next job. Or no sane person, with the lack of match that was there, you know. I'm a country boy. That chicken job was probably a good match for me. But I get this next one. Everybody, it's all three-piece suits, stuffed shirts. We're going to, you know, do some corporate number crunching. And I'm working for a Harvard MBA, and the other guys are Purdue MBA, and the other guys are Vanderbilt MBA, and all of them have CPAs. And here I am with my econ and finance double. And couldn't get in graduate school, you know, with my grades. And the whole time I was there, you know, I interviewed 8 people to get the job, and I just didn't click with any one of them. And finally, one guy I felt a little connection with, and that was enough for me. They offered me the job, and I took it. I mean, my God, it was more money and benefits. Why wouldn't I take it? That's all I'm caring about. I'm not looking to contribute to an organization. I'm not looking to contribute to anybody's life but mine. And this was a major, much better deal than the place I was working, and off I went. And I think from then until 7 years later when I got fired, I spent every day in that place with this feeling that I was just not quite as good as the other people in there. You know, they were just somehow, they knew a little bit more than I did, or got along a little better or something. And on the other hand, they were the dumbest bunch of people I ever saw. I could look at anything they were doing and see how to do it better, you know. And every once in a while, I'd mention that to them. But I was quite a, you know, I had tremendous willpower, tremendous self-will, all of that stuff. I had tremendous drive. Because when they split my department up, I went to my a buddy of mine who had become a manager in another company and I in another department, and I hounded him to death. I said, Robert, you got to get me over here, man. They're doing away with our department. For God's sakes, I'm going to be unemployed, you know. So Robert created a tremendous risk to himself, created a job for me and hired me over there. And I think it was about a year and a half later, I thanked him profusely. I went to the vice president of that department and said, Robert does not know how to use a guy like me. I'm totally underutilized down here. I can't get along with him. What else can I do, you know? And they were like flabbergasted that Robert was doing this stuff. And they moved me over to another department. But that's how I thought. I'd argue with Robert a few times. To me, that was the same as going to him and trying to work this thing out. It was clear to me he wasn't going to roll over and do things the way I wanted him, wanted to do them in there. So I'm in this place, and it's just one goofy thing like that after another. But somehow I keep moving up the chain, you know. It's how goofy some organizations are. I guess you can go up them no matter how poorly you do. But and I say I did poorly. I mean, I'd work all night or whatever, you know. But at the end of the day, you look at a guy that could effectively communicate with other people, that could really contribute to the organization and all that stuff, I wouldn't hit. So I get over in this other department, and by this time, a whole other reorganization is kicking up. Our parent company has been bought out. So the deal is this. They're going to slice about half the company. It's going to be gone. The other half, everybody's going to probably be promoted and have higher paying jobs because we're all going to have more stuff we got to do and this type thing. So somehow I managed to land on the right side of that. I'm going to get promoted again, but a little problem happened. My new boss came to me 2 days before the promotion was supposed to take place. He says, Kent, we've never seen you work in marketing before. You've been over there in finance. What we'd like to do is have you do this for 6 months, and if it looks okay, we'll go ahead and give you the promotion. You know, it's perfectly logical to see how a guy does in a new area. Probably some corporate stuff behind it. We've got all the headcount we can manage at this level right now, but we can work you in there in 6 months. A normal person would have just taken that, rolled with it, got promoted, and gone on, you know. And I got in there, and the alcoholism is working on me, you know. I'm not drunk at work. I mean, some days I'm probably hungover at work or still a little messed up or something, but by and large, I'm just totally sober in here. And what's going on is noise in my head is getting worse and worse. I'm going, man, they are setting me up to get rid of me. I'm going, man, why did so-and-so get over there? And I'm the one that should have gotten over there, you know. I'm over here under this guy, and this is why I'm not working out well in this new place. On and on it went. It's always the employer's fault. They didn't teach me everything they should have before they stuck me down here in the first place, right? And finally, it's so crazy that my alcoholism helped me terminate a career in a matter of minutes. As I was walking out to lunch one day late, and my boss is coming back in, and as friendly as any human on earth, he goes, "Good afternoon, Kent." I said, "F you, Phil." Today I look at it and all I can see is alcoholism. No normal person on the face of the earth would do that to the guy that's signing their check every 2 weeks. Has never really done anything but tried to help him, you know. But I'm so caught up in fear, resentment, jealousy, all these things that are driving my life, especially the fear part, what's going to happen to me. I'm so caught up in that stuff that that's what comes out of my mouth. And Phil was no dummy. In a couple of months, I'm out of that company, you know. And I do what a lot of alcoholics do. I become self-employed. But and I really can't see the severity of the situation I put myself in, you know. I just had a kid 3 months before I told Phil what he could do, you know. I don't think about my wife. I don't think about my kid. All I think about is man, I do not feel right here. And I have this little eruption, and out the door I go. And Richmond's a small town. It's, you know, everybody you might get hired by would call that company and say, "What happened?" And I probably could have gotten hired somewhere if I had persisted long enough, but my alcoholism told me there was no point in it, that people in these organizations were not, the whole structure of it was just not equipped to take advantage of the talents that a guy like me has. I was going to figure out this business thing on my own, start my own company. And I had some equity in my car at the time. I guess that's where I thought I was going to... I guess that's where I thought I was going to fund the startup, you know. So I started looking around, and I said, well, what can you get into with a few hundred dollars? And as I've drank the rest of it away, right? And I said, oh, real estate, I can get in there pretty fast and get something going. Why, a guy who's been an analyst, a number cruncher, or whatever, would think he's going to be a salesman is beyond me, you know. But anyway, that's what I came up with. And off I go, and the heat is on big time, you know. I got a kid. My wife is, she's worked part-time and full-time off and on. I can't remember which phase she was in at that point, but I got to make some money. That's the bottom line. And this is a 100% commission business, right? It actually cost you to be in the thing. But I'm an alcoholic, and I got tremendous drive and willpower. And what I do is I start knocking on doors, and I knock on a few hundred of them a week. And there aren't many people that get their real estate license willing to go out and do this type of stuff. In fact, 98% of people that get in it are out of it within 2 years. And I'm out here knocking on doors, and next thing you know, I've taken over a couple of neighborhoods. And then the business just starts coming faster and faster, you know. And so it went pretty well for a long time, but my alcoholism is getting worse. You see, I'm a guy... That last boss that fired me was an alcoholic, by the way. He's dead today, too. I saw his obituary in the papers. Another guy in our fellowship that used to work with him. We talked about it, but they dragged Phil in front of the whole corporate office, 200 people, called a meeting. There was a number of people that noticed Phil was coming in drunk, you know, liquor on his breath, and he had to stand up in front of this whole crowd and say, I'm an alcoholic, and if any of you see me drinking again, I'm going to be fired. Man, if that wouldn't make a drunk drink, I don't know what would. I mean, my God, it just shows we got a little work to do with employers and professionals out there. But that's what they did to him, and Phil's dead today. But anyway, I thought it was disgusting. I mean, much as I drank at that point, I thought it was disgusting for a guy to come to work with liquor on his breath, you know. I'm like, who would violate the rules like that? You know, same thing back when I worked construction in the summer with my dad. There's always one carpenter or concrete finisher or somebody out there drunk at lunch or drunk all day or something. Disgusting people. Well, when I become the only guy in charge, it was suddenly okay to get up and take a bong hit at 5:30 in the morning. I mean, in fact, I don't think it was okay. I think it was necessary. I think this has become such a normal condition for me that I could not start the day without it. I simply could not get out, get into life, and face life sober without all that stuff starting up in my head. The fear, you know, when am I going to make the next sale? What if these people back out of this deal? And then, and I'd do weird stuff. I'd start replaying telephone conversations after I'd hung the phone up. And I'm sitting there, and then Joe said, blah, 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 blah. Well, I should have said, da, 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 da. And my wife walks by, and goes, who are you talking to? And I'm not even aware I'm doing this stuff, you know, but that's where I've kind of gone. And, but yeah, I could drink enough and kind of quiet that stuff down a while. But I'm having to drink more and more in order to do it. And what happened is in 1990 or so, I found out I was diabetic, and I couldn't believe that either, you know. For some reason, I have an inability to accept some basic facts about life. I went in to get a physical, and I think it's no big deal. I'm going to have another eye surgery after many years to do something with my eye. And the guy comes back out and says, how long have you been diabetic? And again, I'm looking around the room to see who he's talking to. And I'm instantly angry as I don't know what. And it's all emanating out of fear, right? Oh, emanating out of fear. Like, this guy's a, and I call it doc in the box. They call him patient first today. But this guy, doc in the box, doesn't know what he's talking about, you know. I said, I guess. And just to prove it, I went over to Hardee's and had two sausage and egg biscuits. And I said, see there, nothing's wrong with me. And I drive on home. couple of months later, when I'd lost 40 pounds and was down to my high school weight, I said, there might be something wrong with me. I was extremely tired and some other things going on. I go down to MCV. I said, well, they got some real doctors. I'll get down here and see what the story is. So they run the test, and they come in there, and the guy says, yeah, you're diabetic, and you need to start on insulin right away. And so anyway, we're going through the whole deal. He says, you're going to want to exercise. You're going to want to change your diet. And I'm thinking, good, I can do all this stuff. This is probably going to be okay. And I'm about to hop down off the table. And he says, and if I were you, I wouldn't drink anymore. And I stopped hopping in midair, and I looked at him, and I said, you wouldn't drink anymore? You mean nothing? He said, well, you could have a beer or two every once in a while. And I did what every good alcoholic would do. I said, sure, I can do that. And I walked on out the door, and I'm thinking, oh, man, what am I going to do? Because I'm out tearing it up pretty good by now, you know. I got my buddy, and we're out closing every bar in Richmond pretty much every night. And anyway, it was some sad stuff. I had to go around some way. I told you, my wife got a little upset about all this drinking around the house, so usually on the weekend, I got a few single buddies that live around town. I go hang out at their house, you know, and tell the wife I'm going to work, going wherever, and go spend the Saturday afternoon and party with these guys, and people are coming through there like rats to cheese, you know, and we're all in there partying it up, and but I needed some help, you know, and I told these guys, I'm in deep depression and self-pity. I said, this guy told me not to drink anymore. But great minds think alike. Every one of them said, Kent, just smoke marijuana. And I'd been doing that and liked it, so I thought it was an excellent idea. But I think this is where my alcoholism, which was already bad, the drinking and drug inside of it, it took a step up. One guy says, I take it with me everywhere I go. I said, now this guy's on to something. Why couldn't the doctor have come up with something this simple, you know? I started taking it with me everywhere I went, and it just got crazy, you know. If I'm not drinking, I'm doing this stuff, and finally I hated my guts, you know. I'm looking at my life, I'm going, man, I'm doing okay in business, but I'm losing a ton of business and just sailing by that I can't get straightened up in time to go shake somebody's hand and sign a deal with them, you know. I said, man, I kind of had a sense in these moments of clarity, I'm not being the dad I'm supposed to be. I'm not being the father I'm supposed to be. And I think about my dad, and I go, man, my dad did not raise me to be like this, you know. And I just hate myself. And I take this pot and throw it out the window going down some major road, you know. And I'd go on home and sit there and just morbid over what I've become for a couple of hours. And then after 3 or 4 hours, I'm sitting there and I say, what did I do? I threw that pot away. And I'd drive back over there and get it, you know. But I'm a smart guy. I'm going to beat this thing if it's the last thing I do, you know. So, same thing would happen. It finally got to where I'm stealing it from my friends, you know. You get up to a certain age, you scare all the young dealers when you show up on their doorstep. So anyway, I'm stealing this stuff from my friends and just tearing it up for a day and a half. Can't get any effect from it. Hate my guts. I said, whatever you do, don't throw the whole baggie out the window. You'll come pick it up. So I sprinkle it out the window, going down the busiest road I can get on. And that night, I get my big flashlight, and I go back over there and find what I can find, you know. And in fact, one day, I'd been down to visit Mom down in Lunenburg, and threw some out in a soybean field in Blackstone on the way back to Richmond. And it's Monday morning, and I'm going to be on the straight and narrow. I'm going to turn it over, start a new leaf. I'm going to quit forever again. And I've got a list of things I got to get done today, and I've done the first two, and I'm on fire, you know. And here's the third one, and I got a little apprehension about it. Next thing I know, the car is on the expressway headed out of Richmond. I'm 65 miles south in Blackstone in a soybean field. And I go, man, something is not right, but I could get messed up, and I didn't have to think about it too long, you know. And so on it goes, and finally what happened was my brother-in-law got sober. And He was a mess. He, my God, y'all have to get him up here. You want to hear what a bad drunk sounds like. But one day he said, Kent, you might want to come with me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, look at this clown. Gotten him out of more scrapes than I can count. Lent him money. Failed him out of stuff. Written letters trying to keep him in program, medical programs and all this stuff. And he wants me to go with him to the alcoholic meeting. And I said, well, I'll humor the old guy. I'll ride out there with him. And I figured it was going to be Phil and two guys in trench coats from under the Lee Bridge at this thing. And I didn't know what to think. I go in, they open the doors, and there's like 70 people in this room, you know, and it's everybody under the sun, you know. It's construction workers, accountants, doctors, lawyers, and I'm like, my God, I had no idea there were this many people fighting this thing the way I'm fighting it. There were this many people as deep in the battle and losing it as badly as I am, you know. And I really related to that aspect of it, but and I did the best I could with it, you know. They kept saying get a sponsor, so I got a sponsor and get a home group, and I finally signed up at some home group, and they said work the steps, and I kept working through five. I think I got through seven one time. But my alcoholic thinking told me if I made amends, if I went to some of my past clients, some other brokers and agents in town, and said I'm a drunk, this is what I've done to you, what do I have to do to make it right, that I would lose my license, you know, so I wasn't going to do it. I was going to come up with my own way. I was going to just keep going to these five and six meetings a week and exercise and whatever and piece this thing together, talk to the alcoholics every once in a while. And I couldn't make it work, though. I could not stay sober to save my life. And I'm doing this for 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm drunk in AA for 2 years. I mean, and I'm giving it everything I got. I mean, I'm getting 10 days here, and every once in a while I'd hit 30 days. I think I hit 30 days about twice in 2 years. But anyway, I get 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 10 days, 5 days, over and over and over again. I want desperately to stop. But I couldn't do it. And at the end of 2 years, I had a truly insane thought. I said, and I'm having trouble getting sobered up in time to get to the meeting. I didn't like looking like the most messed up person in there, you know. And so I said, well, something's got to go. I either got to quit going to all these AA meetings or something. Quit drinking once and for all. I said, well, I could do both. I quit drinking and I quit going to AA, and this time I'll handle it on my own. I am. The guy that's been trying to cut back for 20 years, right? I've been trying to manage this thing for 20 years. Been marking it off on a day planner at work. Made it 13 days. I'm nuts. I'm going to happy hour. That's what an alcoholic does. You know? I mean, when my dad died, I remember, and I used to tell people, I said, I think I've been fighting it about 10 years, you know? And I remember when my dad died, and I was so moved by his funeral and the way he was respected in the community. I said, I'm going to try to be what he wanted me to be, and I quit. I don't think I made it a month, you know. I said, my God, that was 14 years ago. And then I could remember marking that calendar at work before I get fired in there. I said, man, that was 20 years ago. I've been fighting this tooth and nail for 20 years. But suddenly this day, I had the solution. I was going to handle it on my own. And out the door I went, and I was back out for 2 years. And goofy stuff happened. I mean, I, you know, didn't have a lot of bad outward stuff, just the same thing. Wasn't fulfilling my roles in life. Wasn't losing a lot of business. Wasn't helping out with the kids and all like I should have been. And I hated myself. I think this alcoholism is all an inside job, you know. I don't think it much matters what we look like on the outside, what we have or don't have. It's, can I be comfortable today here living life with you guys sober and with the rest of the world sober? And I couldn't do it, you know. And so stuff starts happening, and I start thinking maybe I need to get back in there. And I remember a guy I met right before I went out. I said, I'm going to get him to sponsor me if I ever go back. And I'd ride around playing my Chuck C CDs every once in a while. It's almost like I knew I was coming back, you know. But I kept fighting it, and one day I was out working on the house. I was putting a patio on because the basement had flooded. I said, well, I'll put a couple of patios back here and keep the water away. So we're putting a patio on, and here comes my neighbor Don. And Don, retired Navy, he was one notch from hitting Admiral, and very straightforward, blunt man. Kept an eye on, sharp eye on the neighborhood, because he's retired now. He walks over. Kent, what are you doing today? A normal guy would have said, Don, I'm putting a patio on. I'm out here all messed up, you know. I'm like, Don, this is what I'm doing. We're grading it down 3/4 inch, coming around this way. This guy's doing it. And I'm about 6 minutes into telling Don what we're doing. And Don got a little bored with it. He looked me right in the eye. He said, Kent, if you didn't smoke so much dope, you'd make a lot more sense. I said, my God, the neighbors are on to me. I had no idea. I've been hiding, you know. I'm down in the tool shed, and I'm in the basement, and I'm riding down the road, and nobody should have known this, but apparently all the neighbors knew and been talking to Don about it. And I hated my guts. I threw my rake down and walked in the house and sat down by the phone book and said, I'm done. And I started calling my sponsor, and he said, well, we'll meet and discuss what a course of action would look like and see if you want to do it. I said, no, I just want to do it. And so we got started, and oddly enough, when I did all those things that you folks told me I had to do, I got sober. You know, I never believed it could work. When I used to read page 84 in the big book where it says we cease fighting everything and everybody, couldn't believe it. We're not going to be tempted by liquor anymore. Couldn't believe it. And when I did this stuff, that's exactly what happened to me. Because all that stuff I didn't do the first time around, I did the second time around. I finished my step work. You know, went all the way through them, didn't I got a sponsor. I engaged with the sponsor this time. When he made suggestions, I paid a little attention to it and did it. You know, I wasn't just calling the guy sponsor. He was actually mentoring me in life. And I joined a home group and got active in it, and I happened to land in one at the right time. It was just kind of starting, and they needed people to do a lot of stuff. And I could get in there fairly new in sobriety and have a lot of stuff to help them out with. And so I got active in a home group, the Unity leg of the triangle. And then I happened to land in a group that does a lot of service work, and I got into service right away. And, you know, 7 months into it, it finally occurred to me I was going to stay sober. About 6 months into it. 7 months into it, my sponsor calls me up. He says, we're heading down to North Carolina for a corrections conference next week or whenever it was. And I'm thinking, corrections? Never been arrested. I don't like the idea of jail in particular. I said, Mark, I think you got the wrong guy. You know, I work on Saturday a lot, and yeah, I don't see any way I can go down there. And basically, I hung the phone up on him. I said goodbye, but it was bye. You know, you get that thing hung up before you put some other thing on me, you know. And I called him back in 10 minutes. I said, when do we leave, you know? There was nothing else to do. I said, man, I've never been sober 7 months since I was way back in my teens somewhere. The only way I got sober was by following this guy's suggestions. And went down there, and I had the time of my life, you know. It's just the most active people in AA you'll find anywhere, the Freedom from Bondage Conference down in North Carolina. And, man, I just enjoyed it. And came back up. I got in corrections work. I'm our corrections chair at Into Action today, and go into Powhatan Prison every Wednesday night pretty much. Go to Richmond City Jail. We're in there every Monday night. And it's the most rewarding stuff I've ever done, you know. You get out there in Powhatan, and I had this guy tell me one night toward the end of the meeting out there, he says, Ken, I was diagnosed with leukemia today. How do I stay sober? Because these guys drink in prison, and they get stuff mailed in there to them and all this, you know. And I said, well, I think your answer is here in the steps. And we sat down and talked about it, you know. And the guy stayed sober, man. And I was just on fire, you know. The whole next day, I'm just totally sane from helping this guy. And it was so different from all that sitting at the meeting and talking like I used to do, you know. And that's what we do. We just got a ton of projects we do in detox centers, IOPs, the correction stuff. We just made a 30-minute video in our public information I want to know when it goes. And I don't, you know, I'm not trying to tell you what a good group we are. I'm trying to tell you that's the only way I stay sober. When I can stay focused on becoming more effective in that stuff, I'm not looking at Kent. When I'm joined in with these other guys and we're working on that stuff, my life works, and I have no idea why. All I know is it works. By being out there at Powhatan on Wednesday night, I'll be sane at work on Thursday. I'll be sane with my family Thursday. And so that's what I do. And it's just night and day from what I did that first couple of years when I was trying desperately to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it's been a pretty amazing trip, really. You know, life's still rough. I'm selling real estate in a depression. And, you know, we're probably in as bad a financial condition as we've been in since we were married. We've been married 21 years, since early in marriage, you know. But then my wife's in Al-Anon, and Billy and I were talking about it before the meeting tonight. She sponsors a whole throng of women down there in Richmond. And despite all this stuff, she looks to me to be as sane as a human can be. And that's a nice statement to be able to say about the woman you've been married to 21 years, you know. And I don't have to drink, you know. I don't have to tell my clients off. I don't have to fire up on other agents. I don't have to do any of that stuff. Like I said, I'm not perfect at it. And if I didn't do this stuff, I'd become very imperfect at it very fast. But by doing it, my business continues to work, and I know I'm going to be okay. By doing this stuff, I can now do all those things that I used to have to be messed up to do, which includes playing ball with my kids, sitting down helping my kids with homework. Man, that is a sad way to go through life, not to be able to help your kids with something unless you're messed up. And, you know, I don't have to live that way anymore, and it's all because of you guys. And so the home front's going well, and AA, you know, it's a constant battle. I love it. I wouldn't, you know, it's the only thing that's ever worked. I tried everything else. I tried exercise, antidepressants, IOPs, acupuncture, half a dozen churches with recovery congregations, everything I could think of. I couldn't put a dent in alcoholism. Left to my own devices, I don't have a chance against this thing is my conclusion. And but to be in here with you guys, I seem to have a pretty good, life seems to work pretty well. And the thing that keeps me sober keeps life working in every department. I don't have to yell at people anymore. I don't have to blow up. I don't have to live in grave fear of what is going to happen next, you know. And I think it just keeps getting better, you know, a little bit at a time. I can look back on it and I say, man, a year and a half sober, I was still looking kind of crazy in retrospect. And I look back on it and I say, man, this craziness came on me last week, you know. But fortunately, I didn't have to get sucked into it and have it take away a day or a week or a month or a year of my life. That's the power this disease has over me, you know. I didn't have to do any of that stuff. And so life's still full of challenges. I think it's just the nature of life, you know. And I think this program gives me a solution to it, a way of living where I can interact with and see the world a little differently and become concerned about other people in life. And it seems to work pretty well. And, yeah, I think it saved our family. You know, I look at where we are and I go, yeah, the finances are tough now. Yeah, we still look like we've got some major hurdles ahead, you know. But, I think you got to look at the other side of it. Where would we be if we hadn't gotten in here? I'm convinced my kids would be almost destroyed by it. I'm convinced that I would be dead or close to death, and I'm convinced my wife would be insane. And I don't say any of that lightly. I don't say any of it lightly. In fact, I'd about guarantee it for anybody that rides this thing long enough. That's what it's going to look like at some point, you know. But the solution's right here with you guys, with good sponsorship, with being in an active home group, and yeah, let's keep going together. I think that's all we can do. And thanks for having me here tonight.